And the journo's in session. Helen Daly is the presenter of Sunday Business and Sunday Agenda on Sky TV. Stephen Mayne, the founder of Crikey.com, which you'll find on the net. And George Negus, the presenter of Dateline on SBS TV. Welcome.
Richard. Hi there.
Thank you, Richard, for coming in. Now, petrol prices spike over $1.60 a litre with predictions of more pain to come. In the end, will rising petrol prices make a substantial difference to the way in which we all live? Or is the car so important to Australians that we'll keep paying whatever it takes to stay in our cars? Oh, and another question. What are the opposition's plans to cut the excise, the petrol excise, to give a little relief? Is that a good idea or economically daft? George Negus.
Are you un-Australian, Richard?
Un-Australian.
I don't know. These are two financially less challenged people than me, but I reckon that Australians would probably pay about $3 if they had to. A litre.
Well, they do in Europe, actually, don't they?
I mean,
well, not quite
that
much.
It wouldn't make a scrap of difference. I mean, there's a license. It's a license to kill the petroleum industry. They could put the price up any way they like. They could blame all international oil prices if they like. They blame, and that would not stop Australians from thinking or wanting other Australians to think that they were so poor they had to use public transport.
You think we'll do anything? We'll eat into all our other forms of spending in order to maintain the family.
I think so. I mean, I'm absolutely convinced. I mean, look at the price of it. I mean, it used to be front page headlines every time it went up by about, a cent. Now it's been going up like a rocket for the last couple of years. Nobody even blinks.
Yeah. Oh, well, we blink. The pain is very real. It's just...
Yeah, not enough to make us use public transport or start demanding more public transport. We just buy bigger and bigger and more oil-consuming, petrol-consuming cars.
Okay, the reality is we love our cars too much. Is that right, Stephen Mayne?
Look, it is right. George, imagine if the currency was still at 47 cents like 5 years ago. We'd be paying
$3.20. That's
right. It'll less four-wheel drives. It'll work at the margins. But at the end of the day, it's going to cause, economic slowdown. It's going to see a huge transferal of wealth to the oil-rich countries and away from those that aren't oil-rich.
But which again has a big impact on foreign affairs and
big
world power.
Big geopolitical impacts, but won't affect Australians driving their cars. And although the one area where it will is gas. We have masses of gas and fast dwindling oil supplies. So the gas conversion and us tapping into our vast gas riches should be dramatically sped up, given that we've got so much of it.
Okay, but why do we love our cars so much that we... You would think, given these prices, that maybe we would be... demanding, I mean, people are demanding public transport, but we'd be virtually marching on Parliament to demand it.
Well, I just think that, we love the security of our cars. I mean, I was at the Macquarie Airport's AGM today and they were saying people are going to keep travelling. Despite oil prices, global travel is going to keep rising. It's a function of a wealthy society, mobility, getting around.
And being a suburban society rather than an urban society. If we didn't have to travel so bloody far, we wouldn't have to drive so often.
Yeah.
I mean, we are this mad suburban thing, Australia. If we discourage suburbs, which is almost an un-Australian comment as well, and encouraged inner-city urban living to a greater extent, we might be a lot better off in a million ways, including this whole fuel consumption.
Helen Daly.
Well, I'll be the contrarian. I think it is going to make a difference, much like it did mainly in the US, not as much here, but much like it did in the last, the first two oil shocks
in
back,
the 70s.
30 years ago, when particularly in America, it forced the car makers to go a lot stronger with their designs of smaller cars. And Americans moved from big yank tanks, as we used to call them, to much smaller cars. Now, Australia also moved to a lot smaller cars and moved away from the big family sedans that many of us, certainly not moi, many of us grew up with in the 60s.
It's still
and 70s.
A change at the margins, as Stephen says, though, isn't it? It's a sort of little shift rather than a wholesale change in the way we live.
Well, I think it probably is going to lead to a kind of a wholesale shift. I do think we are going to be forced to think about, well, do I want to spend the money on the petrol to drive 3 kilometres to school or to drop people wherever, or do I actually want to save that, get on the bus, work out how we can do that, or push our governments to get a better mass transport system?
Well, that's the trouble in Sydney, isn't it?
It's a particularly bad problem for a lot of Sydney.
I mean, for some people it's okay, but for a lot of people it is very difficult to choose public transport because it's simply not there.
No, so you do have to almost get out in the streets and force governments to plan this a lot better. I mean, the New South Wales government has been so lax with, they promised many rail lines, they've promised us metro now. I mean, when are we going to see it? And I do think a lot more people would use it. That's right. It's always further out. And then there's some reason why they don't go ahead with planning it. But I agree with George that also because of our urban and suburban sprawl, that really makes it difficult for us not to rely on a car.
It's coming with Kevin Rudd's Building Australia Fund.
Ah, Helen, yes, that's right, the Building Australia Fund.
That's what they had in mind.
Transport, ports, rail, and all those other things.
He has actually
really
mentioned
I'm sure
that,
the mass
he?
Transport
yeah,
system.
There is an agenda, it's not just a name, it's, so there is a purpose to the
exercise. And the surpluses are going into it.
Yeah, and, well, the, and the states and the federal government are going to cooperate so beautifully.
Right. It's going to be
just
done
before
really
the elections. Because at the budget lockup, Anthony Albanese stood up straight after Wayne Swan and started talking about all these great projects in Sydney.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, the feds are really stepping in.
Sydney Keatingism.
There's a history with these things, and we are waiting until we're sitting on that train with our bums in the seats before we believe
exactly.
It.
Now, as for the opposition's plans, if I can jump in there to, you know, cut the petrol excise, which was the second part of your question, I think Malcolm Turnbull's views really seem to sum it all up rather neatly. I mean, we believe that he complained to Brendan Nelson in some emails that it was bad policy to cut the petrol excise. But yesterday, the best face he could put on it was that it was very good politics for an opposition to do that. So what may be good for an opposition to play at by digging into the government is essentially bad policy.
For 5 cents off the price of petrol, that's got to look good today, doesn't it, Stephen May?
Well, it's $1.8 billion and you're paying 5 cents less. I can't believe all these people who say it doesn't matter, it will get lost in the ups and downs of the oil price. Of course it matters. It's $1.8 billion a year. And I think that the Rudd government blundered because they slapped an extra $550 million a year tax on the Northwest Shelf. So they got a bonus.
This is the Woodside
tax. Yeah. They got a bonus $550 million from a tax slug, and they should have done 2 cents off the excise. They should have linked the two. They should have gone $550 from Woodside, $550 off the motorists.
No, but why should Woodside have this? They've had it for 30 years. Why do we need to keep supporting the Northwest Shelf? It should be supported. You said we've got so much gas.
But they're
tax-free.
They shouldn't get a tax holiday.
Why should they have an exemption?
Well, they shouldn't. I'm saying we should slug them.
They remove the exemption.
We got more revenue by slugging them, and we should have returned that specific revenue to the long-suffering motorists.
Okay, but the argument on the other side is that all it takes is for an oil sheik to fart in bed and the price goes up by 10 cents. So what's the big deal?
But that's actually a completely flawed argument, because it would go up by 5 cents rather than 10 cents after
money,
the sheik farted because of the taxes come down by 5 cents.
It might be an interesting argument if it was happening three weeks before an election, but it's a pretty innocuous sort of argument at the moment. It's not going to go anywhere. I mean, oppositions can say those sort of things. I just think the carry-on between Malcolm and Brendan is just fantastic. I mean, you think of the politics of this country is really quite wacky. You've got a Liberal Party that is going through a leaderless identity crisis, doesn't know what it is. We know it's not Liberal. It should be the Conservative Party, led by a bloke who's a former member of the Labor Party and a doctor, who's being challenged by a bloke from Point Piper, who only joined the Liberal Party because they asked him first. Yeah. Both vying to be alternate prime ministers, and we call it serious oppositional politics. It's a joke. I mean, they don't even know what they stand for as a party. We don't know. Have you heard any of the analysis suggesting what Malcolm stands for and what Brendan stands for? No, because nobody knows what they stand for.
Well, there you go. The world according to George Negus. 6:15 is the time. We have George, Stephen Mayne and Helen Dalley with us. Talking about the opposition, let me get you on that, Stephen Mayne. There is this view that Dr. Nelson is really just waiting as that sort of 10-ton truck called Malcolm Turnbull rolls down the highway towards him. Is that what is happening? Is it almost inevitable that he is going to be the one who takes the pain and then hands over to Mr. Turnbull?
Yes. I mean, Brendan Nelson is unelectable. He's 17%. He's been in single digits. You look at his speeches at the press club. His budget reply was a little bit better, but he's a bit of a laughingstock, really.
Is that his fault or is it just the position in which history has put him?
Oh, look, it's tough being in opposition, but I think Malcolm just has a bigger aura about him. He just presents better. He's more.
Nick Minchin doesn't think so. Nick Minchin doesn't think Malcolm's electable either. And he might be right.
And someone, perhaps a third party, a mischievous, perhaps someone who was formerly at the top of the government or near the top of the government, leaked the emails or the existence of the emails anyway. So someone also doesn't like
that. Are you trying to say that Peter Costello leaked the email to damage Malcolm? Certainly damaged him.
Mr. Turnbull, though, everyone says, made an excellent budget speech at the press club the other day.
And sorry, going back to Stephen's comment, I think Brendan Nelson did make a really good budget reply speech in the Parliament last week. And I do think that Malcolm Turnbull has been flip-flopping very much on inflation. At first he was saying, you know, a few months ago, oh, there's no real inflation crisis, the government's talking it up. Then he says the budget's, you know, tremendously inflationary, and now they seem to have moved around from that. But just on that point, I do think that, you know, a lot of people have a kind of memory loss, and that after the 96 election loss to the Labor Party, I mean, they struggled for a long time to get both the leader right and their policy platform
right. This is
the
Peacock years.
No, no, sorry. The Labor Party. Oh, the Labor Party. After the 96 election loss, when John Howard won, the Labor Party struggled. I mean, Simon Crean did struggle as leader. They had to reform themselves internally, and that was a ginormous fight between particularly Crean taking on the unions, and even Kim Beazley struggled a lot. So people do forget that it is a bit cyclical, and certainly the first 6-8 months after an election loss, when Kevin Rudd won with such a big margin.
And when you've been in power for so long,
impossible to get it together.
Yeah. I seriously think, though, there are people in the Liberal Party who don't think that Malcolm is the automatic solution.
No, I would agree with that too.
He'll never be Prime Minister. I mean, there's no way Rudd's going to get 2-3 terms easily. I reckon Malcolm should follow his advice to Julie Bishop. He went and saw Julie Bishop and said, go back and become Premier of WA, replace the chair sniffer. I think he should follow his own advice. I mean, don't you think Malcolm should come and be the Premier of New South Wales?
You've got to be joking.
Wouldn't be a big enough job for him.
Oh, instant expertise is one of Malcolm's strong points. But
he's such
being
a sippy
an instant expert in state politics.
So. Mr. Millionaire Silvertail from Point Piper won't work.
Okay. Turnbull for Premier.
Bit small time for Malcolm.
12 to 6.
The Drive Show. On 702 ABC Sydney.
We'll check the Sydney traffic in a tick. We have George Neger, Stephen Mayne and Helen Daly with us. Now, the retiring boss of Macquarie Bank, Alan Moss, walks away with $80 million, causing all of Sydney to yell to the rooftops, no wonder it costs so much to park at the airport. Everyone from the PM down calls for business leaders to show restraint, but they say they're just working in a globalised area and are merely paying themselves the going rate. Is that a fair point? Stephen Mayne, you went to the Macquarie AGM today.
I did go to the Macquarie AGM today, where Max Moore-Wilton, the former head of the Prime Minister's Department, who's now the chairman, gloated that Sydney Airport is worth substantially more than $11 billion. So I think you must be all paying an absolute
mainly
poultice.
Due to the parking, yeah.
Yeah, but no, I think that Alan Moss does deserve it. He's taken the Macquarie share price from $6 to $60 over his 15 years in charge, and Macquarie is one of the few genuine global success stories. They control more infrastructure assets around the world than anyone else, and any Australian company that can go into the heart of the Roman Empire, buy Rome Airport and sell it 5 years later for $1 billion clear profit, for me,
when everything else in Italy is going down
for me,
is
an absolute legend.
If you George Negus, if you were a Macquarie shareholder, you wouldn't begrudge this bloke the money, because he's multiplied your money by 10 times.
Forget being a Macquarie shareholder, which I'm not, disclaiming.
Well, you might be if you've got superannuation. Because your super fund might have shares.
And I have a blind portfolio. You financial experts will know about what a blind portfolio is. I don't know what I have. Seriously. Which is an interesting point for another discussion sometime. But, I mean, if this bloke Moss is worth, you use the word deserve, which is an interesting term, if he's worth $80 million, right, he's so
in a year.
He's so good, we should forget elections, we should get party rules, we should draft him now to run the bloody country.
Well, his wife
he's worth $80 million. The Prime Minister, what, gets 400 grand or something?
His wife, Irene Moss, was the head of ICAC for a while up here, so she was keeping the pollies honest.
I mean, he is the smartest man in the land. If he's worth $80 million, he should be running the joint.
Yep, well,
not a bank, the country.
But he says, look, this is...
We know he isn't that smart, so why bother talking about it?
They say this is a globalised business, this is what people get paid for doing this work in America and England. We are particularly successful at it in international terms. Why are you all winking?
Would he be a better CEO if he got $8 million a year? Would he be a better CEO if he got 800 grand a year? I know he couldn't live on 80, but I mean, just keep taking off a naught. Is he a better CEO because he gets 80 grand? Rubbish.
Helen Daly.
Look, I do feel mixed about this, because I'm really, I agree with George about a lot of what he says. I also agree with Stephen. I do think what Alan Moss and David Clark and Nick Moore, who are the big executives at Macquarie Bank, what they pay themselves in salary and then how much they take out in profit, which is a lot of what this $80 million payment is really up to the shareholders who allow this to happen by voting for it and saying yes.
What are you doing, Stephen?
But even after building the bank up over 30 years, and particularly the last 15 when, you know, we've had an enormous boom, really, It does stick in people's craw because many of us pay for Macquarie Bank's kind of profits, particularly when they gouge fees out on things like airports and what have you. And the business community also are the first to scream if unions go and argue for a pay rise for your average worker. But, you know, so what's good for the gander is not good for the goose. If I said that right. But anyway, wait a minute. But then anyone, as I say, anyone who has superannuation may have, you know, their superannuation fund may have put money into Macquarie Bank funds, and they're earning part of, you know, so they're getting the benefit of part of these profits.
And when
as
you
well.
Retire, you'll be so well paid because you're super, you'll be able to go to the airport.
The 80
and park
million.
Once
yes, exactly. But no, in my book, nobody, no one deserves that amount unless they can come up with a cure for cancer or can cure the common cold. But I mean, that's what deserves the money, not
the
just running a financial business.
Colin Moss's salary is only 620 grand a year. The rest is bonus share. The rest is profit share.
It's only a measly 620 grand.
Where's the rest of it? 55% of the profits go between 13,000 staff around the world. So they average 300,000 per staff member. So they're the highest paying employer in the country. Yeah. But, I mean, they do push the envelope. I mean, today I was at Macquarie Airports. I said to Max Morwilton, come on, Max, it's time to get out of Bermuda. I mean, you've got all these Bermuda things. You know, you're the chairman for life. You don't get re-elected because the Bermuda laws don't require you. You know, you're avoiding tax and, you know. Just, you know, Labor's in power now. You're no longer the Prime Minister's great mate. Let's get with the program and clean up your governance. But you're still doing a great job. Oh, Bermuda's a wonderful, well-respected financial centre of the world.
And I pay my fair share of tax too, I bet.
It is 7 to 6. 7:02 traffic. On the roads, Bexley North, multiple vehicles involved in an accident on the M5 East motorway approaching Bexley Road. That's city bound with one lane gone. At Newtown, a bus breakdown, King Street at Missenden Road. That's northbound at Bexley North, a truck breakdown. The M5 East motorway just past the main tunnel. That one's westbound with one lane gone. At Smithfield, we've got a truck breakdown, Cumberland Highway at the Horsey Drive. It's affecting southbound traffic. And finally, at Bexley North, some debris. It's packs of paper, apparently. The M5 East motorway just past Bexley Road. Westbound on 702 ABC Sydney, 6 to 6. With us this evening from Dateline on SBS TV, George Negus, from Crikey.com, Stephen Main, and from Sky TV, Helen Dalley. Now, Barack Obama is playing the game as if he's already beaten Hillary Clinton to be the Democrat nominee. But Senator Clinton is still refusing to give up. Is she showing guts and determination, or just a blind refusal to admit defeat? George Negus.
No holding back Hillary, is there? I think the most amazing thing about the whole silly 6 months or so that we've been watching these two belt the hell out of each other is that I always was silly enough to think that it was the Republican candidate that they were supposed to be belting, not each other. But only in American politics could they go through this rubbish and then somehow or other kiss and make up. I've spoken to a few luminaries from the States in the program recently, and they still think that the dream ticket is possible.
Oh, surely
the
not.
The two of them.
Surely not.
But, George, isn't this democratic to have them at least fighting their way to the top of their own party rather than somebody in a back room a group of cigar-smoking boys in Washington saying, yes, you'll be it this time?
I don't know whether it's democratic, but they love it.
Well, it's sort of, because it's such a stoush now, it probably is the most democratic.
But since everyone's...
But they've both been making noises about how wonderful each other is and how they're commending them for their positive qualities. They both have been saying this of late.
Given that no one seems to think she can win from this point, isn't she just ripping the party apart for no good reason, Helen Dalley?
Look, I know it's unpopular to stick up for Hillary, and I know a lot of people, you know, vehemently can't bear her. And it also is amazing having her team publicly stand up and state, as they were last week, that they won't accept any math, as the Americans like to say, the figures. They won't accept any accounting.
They're so busy they can't say the word maths.
No, that's right. Or they won't accept any mathematics that doesn't include the states of Florida and Michigan. And now we're starting to get very into detail, and I won't bore anyone with that. But, you know, these are...
But in Michigan, to count Barack Obama's name wasn't even on the... ballot.
That's right.
So how can you count those
votes? That's right. And these are decisions that the Democratic National Committee has made to say those two states are they counted themselves out. Florida went too early or something. There was some drama with that, and they won't be counted. So Hillary's people, you know, hands on hips saying, well, we won't accept anything that doesn't count in their delegates.
You do that very well, actually.
I do.
Obama's people today were apparently saying that they're prepared to go further than halfway on this issue of Michigan and Florida, which means what? Oh, well, forget Michigan because I didn't have my name on the ticket, but we will count Florida because we think we'll probably win that anyway.
Oh, look, it's ridiculous.
Stephen Mayne.
Oh, they've got to wind it up. I mean, at least they've toned down the angry rhetoric. Mm. And Helen was celebrating the democratic process. I mean, I agree. You know, wouldn't it be great to see Brendan and Malcolm having 22 television debates over 6 months
it
to
would
decide?
It would be. It would be.
No, I think three or four would be enough.
I don't think Sky would televise that many.
No, that's right. So I think she's got
that would make the grass, watching the grass grow, look really, really exciting.
Yeah, she's got to wind it up.
It is 3 minutes to six on the journey. It's a writers' festival this week in Sydney. Which was the book, fiction or non-fiction, which did most to colour the way you look at the world? A kind of political question, I guess. Stephen Mayne.
As a 14-year-old, Lord of the Flies, William Golding.
That helped you understand the business community.
Well, partly, yes. But what happens to men, boys without rules in a society? Well, I think it's sort of stuck with me.
So the importance of having a structure, of
That's
having
right.
a framework. George Negus.
Other than my own books, you mean?
George!
I write the books I write to try and help me work out what I think the world is all about.
So you're like Elle Macpherson, you only read books written by yourself.
You're like, well, Shane Warne only reads his own book written by somebody else. But I think probably the Aristos by John Fowle had a gigantic impact upon me.
Why so?
It explained sort of small p politics to me in a way that I'd never really understood in my teens. But I've bought so many copies of the Aristos, which is supposed to be about individuality, which is what it means in Greek, as I understand it. But actually means much more than that. It's where the individual fits into society, which has become a bit of a microcosm of my overall view of things.
Okay, so a book about the individual from George, a book about the sort of social structure and the necessity for laws and structures from Stephen. What about you, Helen Daly?
Well, I think it's impossible to name one, but I will nominate one that sort of opened my very naive, rather innocent schoolgirl eyes, and that was King Lear. And I think because of the cruelty, the humiliation, and yet the great love and respect that was also part of that, the falling
I think
from grace.
She sees herself as Cordelia, don't you?
No, not necessarily.
She's a Shakespearean character.
No, but, you know, the ambition and there were so many things wrapped up in that story, and I think perhaps I hadn't thought of the world as such a complex and that there was such kindnesses but human frailties as well.
And the great thing about that is kindnesses that have been ignored by the person, the father, the Lear, who was the subject of those kindnesses.
Mm. Oh, and he was such a flawed, you know, incredibly flawed character in my memory.
Do you think basically that Shakespeare maybe writes better than George? I mean, what's your view on that?
At least we know for sure that I wrote mine. We don't know about
so
you.
Now we're questioning whether Shakespeare wrote it.
Oh, hell yeah. You've got to get in there.
We know all your books were written under a pseudonym by Shane Warne. Co-written by Shane Warne and Elle Macpherson.
What's yours, Richard?
Yeah, what's
the Bible?
Yours?
I don't know. I think maybe Ragged Trousered Philanthropist. Maybe that.
The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist?
Well, it's a longer title than yours. See you later. George Negus, Stephen Mayne and Helen Daly.
Thank you.
You have a great night. TGIF on your radio tomorrow, of course. But right now, some news.